Welcome to season 4 of the Intersection Hub podcast. This season, we are changing the conversation. We are going to go beyond talking about the challenges the charitable sector faces and start spotlighting charities who are offering us hope, hope for a new way forward in 3 primary areas. That's right. In this season, we are sharing 8 real examples of organizations who are advancing anti-racist work, moving forward with trust-based philanthropy, and taking care of the physical and mental well-being of their staff. So thank you for sharing a little bit of your day with us. Let's get to it. Can you imagine working in an organization that pays you a livable wage, gives you time to rest and rejuvenate, and sees taking care of your physical and mental health as part of their mission delivery? I know it sounds impossible, but it is. It is possible. And today we have a fabulous case study of an organization that does all of those things and more for their people. In episode 1 of season 4 of the Intersection Hub podcast, I am so happy to welcome Brandon Yan into conversation. Brandon is an executive director of Out on Screen, which is a charity in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And this organization is building an equitable society where gender and sexual diversity thrives. And they're starting that with their own staff. Just imagine that. At the start of our conversation, Brandon will tell you more about his organization Out on Screen. For now, I'll tell you about him. He is an optimistic and driven nonprofit senior leader, adept at managing operations, programming, and cultivating constructive relationships with a wide range of stakeholders and community partners, all to advance equity and inclusion. You will hear that Brandon is an active and empathetic listener who has a passion for social justice, intersectional feminism, and LGBTQ+ rights. In this episode, Brandon shares how his organization is building a culture of psychological safety and well-being for their staff. And they do this by reducing meetings, having 4-day work breaks, paying livable wage, and prioritizing the health and well-being of their staff as part of a key component of mission delivery. That's right. They're looking at their mission and they're asking themselves, are we treating our staff the way we want our stakeholders to treat people? This is a fabulous conversation, and I just love chatting with Brandon, and I know that you will enjoy this conversation too. So let's get into it. Brandon, I am so happy to welcome you into the Hub. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm excited to talk to you because you were referred to me as an executive director that is putting the health and mental fitness and health and well-being of their staff as a priority this year. And I wondered if you could, you know, I'm grateful to you for coming here to chat a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to getting to know you. Let's just start by giving people a little bit of an overview of what Out on Screen does. What is your mission and mandate, and where are you in that, all that?
Yeah, so the ED hat talking about mission is, our mission is to illuminate, celebrate, and advance queer lives through film, education, and dialogue. And we do that through our 2 core programs, one being the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, which happens every year in August. This year, it's August 10th to the 20th. It's our 35th year this year. And then our other program is Out in Schools, which has been running since 2004. And we essentially take conversations about gender and sexuality, and we have those conversations using film into schools across BC.
Mm. My mind went to Vancouver because we've talked about this. I lived in my early 20s in Vancouver, and I love that city. It's where my heart beats the best. So before we get, we'll have a link to our website for folks who really are keen to learn more about your organization. We'll have a link in the show notes. But before we get started, tell us a little bit about you, other than the official bio that we can all read on LinkedIn. But what would people be surprised to know about you?
Good question. I would say, I'm the oldest of 5 kids. I have a big kind of queer family, trans sibling, gay sibling, and then two folks who apparently are straight. We're just still waiting for them to
So
come
they
out.
say,
I'm just
yeah.
joking. They're getting married
Yeah.
soon. Yeah, and I would say interesting things. I ran for Vancouver City Council in 2018, which was a little bit of a whim. Came close. It's wild to think that I got like 36,000 votes and still didn't win. So it's one of those weird Vancouver election quirks is that it's an at-large system. And then the other weird thing I think, or weird, interesting thing that I would usually use, like tell two truths and a lie. My family briefly moved to the Caribbean when I was a kid. And so we lived on the island of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, which is actually where my maternal grandfather was born. So, yeah,
Is
family.
that's one of your truths? What's
That is one of my truths, yes.
the lie that you usually pull out at parties? Like, I want to know.
Oh, I don't even know what I would lie about. I don't know. I can't
They
remember
never
the lie. It's been
mind.
a while since we've had those opportunities to be in a party,
I
like
know
icebreaker situation or
we don't know how to
conference.
party anymore. Yeah, we
Yeah.
don't know how to do that
Yeah.
anymore. We need to brush off those skills. So let's talk about your staff. How long have you been working with Out on Screen, and what's kept you there?
Well, I've been working with Out on Screen since 2015. So I just had my 8-year anniversary or so LinkedIn liked to remind me about. And I started as a program coordinator with Out in Schools. And I guess I was just good at what I was doing, and they just kept promoting me. And the opportunity came up in early 2020, where our last executive director announced her resignation. At that point, I was already deputy executive director. So I had moved from coordinator to education director to deputy executive director. I did not initially apply as executive director because I don't think anyone really wants
I
to
was gonna
dream to
say,
be.
yeah, like who raises their hand for that job, really?
Also, as the pandemic is happening, it's just like,
Right.
it's one of those things where it's like, But what I would say is, I think my experience as a staff member and working in the nonprofit sector, I think what I was keen to do was actually the work that we're going to be talking about, which is how do we turn the care and attention that we give our communities inward? How do we see ourselves as part of our mission? Because I don't think that that was necessarily the case prior. And as an organization that is for the benefit of 2S LGBTQI plus people, we are every employee is part of that community. And so if we were to fail ourselves, I think we fail at our mission. So that was kind of the challenge to myself. And eventually did apply and got the job. I also think that because of the tumultuous nature of the pandemic for lots of organizations, I think having an external person take over an organization at that particular point in time would have been disastrous.
Yeah,
And not to say
also,
that someone couldn't handle it, but I
yeah,
think
but
it's.
the organizational history and the quick changes you probably needed to make, it would just be a real challenge to get up to speed on all that.
Yeah, that kind of like continuity, I think, was really important for organizations because I did see, and we still continue to see struggles in senior leaderships and nonprofits, even here in Vancouver. Like, I just, not naming names, I just saw an arts organization announce their like fourth ED in like 2 years.
Right.
So, and that's seems to be quite normal these days. I even tweeted the other day being like, I feel like an outlier being an ED that's survived the pandemic.
And still likes their job. Yeah. Still
Yeah.
excited about your work. Yeah.
I mean, like, maybe a strong choice of words depending on the time of year that you ask me, but I would say I still care deeply. And that, I mean, I would consider myself deeply an empath and someone who is maybe a bit too idealistic for their own good, but which is like kind of how the nonprofit sector thrives. But yeah, I just care a lot about because I've seen that kind of work firsthand working in schools and bringing kind of those conversations to youth. I've seen the transformative power that happens in cinemas and to folks like they change their minds about certain opinions and things because art has the power to do that. And that kind of keeps me going. Those little nuggets of things. What doesn't like make me thrive is sometimes the bureaucracy of being the senior administrator, but we're kind of the behind the scenes folks. So yeah.
Or I'll just say from my perspective, maybe government grants.
Yeah.
You're a great podcast guest because you've already given me like way more questions than we have time for today. But I'm curious about just holding space for an unpacking a little bit this concept of see ourselves as part of our mission. Because I think I know what you mean, and I know our listeners are super smart, but it's worth just digging into a little bit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I mean by that, I think, is, we tend to hire, obviously, folks who identify as 2S LGBTQI plus. And, as a nonprofit, typically, and I think a lot of nonprofits also, especially of our size, like we're year round, we're about 8 to 10 staff. And then we kind of double during festival season. But we always hire lots of young folks. And so I think we do a great disservice if in their mind, they join an organization that they feel passionate about. And I think that's kind of how the nonprofit sector works in general. You love the cause, the mission, the mandate, the impact, but the work itself tends to burn people out quite quickly. And I think keeping people excited about the mission and also feeling like they are making that impact is really key. Not just from a outside the whole like in capitalistic idea of employment and like ROI or whatever you want to call it, but I think there's been a huge shift in the way that we see ourselves at work since the pandemic started. I think employees and I think workers have much more leverage than they've had in the most recent working history, at least since I've been working, where we have choices, whether, we can work remotely anywhere in the world. We're seeing, quote unquote, the great resignation, whatever you want to call it. There's been a dynamic shift, right? And so part of it is retention. How do we keep folks so that we can keep doing our programming? But then also, how do we make it so that we don't burn out and then we become disillusioned either with the movement or with the work or the impact, so that we can keep these folks kind of hopefully being lifelong advocates for our communities moving forward.
So the conversation around burnout in our sector and the conversation around staff retention have been going on long before COVID.
Yeah.
This concept of part of the mission is taking care of the staff, advocating for the staff, and keeping them mentally fit and healthy is the job.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's also because we are so geared towards these structures in the sector, especially around like grants and funders. And it's always about this external impact of like, and it's, that consistent fight about like, what's your overhead? What's your admin? I'm like, you mean the people that do the job that you want us to do?
Yeah.
And so I think it's just a shift in that kind of thinking of like, oh, like retention, employee well-being is actually an impact of the funding that you give us. So like seeing that as part of the work, I think is really key. And I know that some funders don't care, but yeah.
Imagine a world if we changed the conversation and said, one of our deliverables is how long our staff stay.
Yeah. Well, or like
a great metric. Yeah.
Or like, like mandatory is maybe not the right word, but like increases to pay and salary so that like, that as a funder, you are going to get consistent impact because you have employees staying longer, right? Like that's kind of like the hope that we see in that shift. Cause I think that's really key.
I want to talk about how you keep people excited about the mission, but you mentioned, livable wages. And I know we talked about this before, but you're one of the few executive directors. And if there are more out there, I want to hear from you because this season is all about amplifying organizations who are doing this kind of work so well. You're very committed to a livable wage for your staff and you operate out of Vancouver.
Yeah. So one of the easy bits about that is that we signed on to the livable wage commitment. And so we are a certified living wage employer, which means that every year when the organization, I think they now work under Vancity Credit Union, they were kind of rolled into that credit union. They will reach out to us being like, hey, here's the new livable wage, and this is how we determined what the number is. Please report back on if your staff are at this level or if you have plans to increase people to this level, and then we will recertify you. So it's like that peer pressure is really good for us because it's like keeps us accountable.
Right.
But then also I think for prospective employees as well, it's one of those things where like, okay, well, like I know if I apply for this job, I mean, we also post salary ranges, so it's never going to be a guess, but right now in Vancouver, it's $24.08 for per hour as a livable wage. And I know that still is too low, but for us as a floor, it's a good kind of like North Star of figuring out how to pay people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is a big increase from the wage at what I think it went up like $2, I think, from what it was set at last year. It was kind of frozen during the pandemic. It also went down at one point in the last 4 years because of the new, our provincial government made a bunch of investments in childcare. So it actually brought childcare costs down. But generally speaking, yeah.
There aren't a lot of charitable organizations that are certified livable wage employers. Mm-hmm. And your commitment to that as a relatively smallish charity, you're what, $1 million to $1.5 million budget?
Yeah, we're last year, I think, was like just over a mil.
Yeah. So for a smallish organization, a commitment to be able to pay their staff, I'm not going to say fairly, but, and I'm not going to say best practice, but what is considered to be a livable wage in your community is a significant commitment.
Yeah. And I think that's like, that's, again, kind of like the bare minimum I see. And I think that is the thing about becoming an executive director is that the buck kind of stops with you, right? There is no one to complain about. I mean, there is a board staff dynamic, the board ED dynamic, but I have a good board, but it's just one of those things where generally speaking, if there's a problem, like you're the one in the position to make a change.
Right.
And so wages was really easy. Like I just kind of built off the last ED's commitment to living wage. Mm-hmm. But what I've been able to do is fight for essentially like mandatory increases in the last couple of years as well. So like this year we set increases at minimum 3% just because like that's kind of like, again, the floor, whereas like I want folks to at least get a 3% increase this year, regardless of performance or whatever. It's just a, things are expensive. And so if they're not getting regular increases, you know, that's a problem.
Do you have those conversations with your donors? I mean, obviously you have the conversations with your board, and I'm just going to assume that they're on board with that every time the budget comes around. Do you run into tension with funders on this commitment?
Not so far. For a lot of our kind of like government funders, I'll usually report back on like kind of like where we spent our resources and kind of our commitment as a, you know, as a social justice, or as an organization that says that social justice is what we do. I do report back to our funders on those types of things, being like, we gave all of our staff a 3.5% increase this year, a bonus. This is how, you know, we've also like increased sick days, and like kind of, again, they didn't necessarily ask for that information, but I think it's important that they hear it.
Right.
For this year applying for funding, I always like, you know, we talk about inflation, but like, what does that mean? So for me, it's like, this is where my increase in the ask is going to go. Like we're going to pay people more regardless if you give me the money or not, but you know, it will create a problem down the line if you don't. So, you know,
Yeah. And the beautiful thing about that is that that opens the eyes of the donors who typically are probably many times successful business people who understand that in their sector, but have a double standard when it comes to thinking about us poor in charitable sector, right?
Yeah, it's like that vow of poverty that we were apparently all supposed to take.
Have to take. Yeah, no, we don't, folks. We do not.
Like I'm over the scarcity mindset, and also the, you know, we have to be martyrs in order to do this work. So
which is exactly why you're committed to this healthy workplace. So how do you keep your staff excited about the mission?
Well, I think part of it, and I think maybe the excitement feels, I don't know, maybe it's too strong, but it's like one of those things where I think we're still very focused on the mission. I think one way to do that is to continually share impact with the whole staff of like every time like the kind of direct program staff go into the field, sharing the stories that they get to experience as those staff with everyone so that it keeps us kind of motivated. Like, all right, like me filling out this grant means that we'll have like 10 times many of these stories. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about providing that impact to our funders, but also to ourselves.
Right.
That is definitely very motivating for us. I think also when we do certain things, when we do certain activities, making sure that we are doing them in a way that aligns with our values. So what I mean by this is that we used to, I think we chatted before about this, but we used to do this big fall art auction gala and it raised a lot of money.
Right.
But we are a film-based organization. We are an arts-based organization, but you know, the people who would go to that particular event wouldn't necessarily be people who would come to our usual programming. They're not the community we typically want to serve. It's great that we took their money, but it's also, you know, how do we actually combine those two things? How do we bring relevant, interesting events to folks, raise money from our community, and show them the impact? And so, you know, it might mean giving up the person who's going to spend $10,000 on a piece of art, and maybe we'll see them once a year. Mm-hmm. And instead, maybe getting a bunch of folks donate $15 a month at a lower level, but who are directly more invested in what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of also the shift that we're trying to do. Like, I know that there's, we just hired a consultant who you know, but through community-centric fundraising, those kinds of principles, I was very interested to see that organized, like kind of like grassroots movement launch. And I'm like, yes, tell me more about this community-centric fundraising thing.
So when you look at the community-centric fundraising principles and you see and you read them and you really learn about it, it makes sense. And mm-hmm. so the idea of shifting away from an auction that isn't really, I mean, you could do a stretch and say it's on brand and on mission, but it wasn't really.
Yeah.
And creating that shift within your organization to, again, it's about serving the needs of your community and building force loyalty within your donors. So let's talk about some of your priorities when it comes to, you know, what really sets you apart, your organization apart, when it comes to prioritizing the mental fitness and mm-hmm. the well-being of your staff.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things when I became ED was apparent, like also during COVID, it was just like, you know, sick days, let's just increase them. It's not where I want them at. I would rather, I think there's some more liberal policies I would like to bring in with regards to sick days, but we did make changes so that folks could have confidence that if they did get sick, they would be taken care of.
Yeah.
I think also things like, you know, if you need to go get vaccinated, taking the day off for, you know, whatever. There are things like we just recently this year as a team got together, one of our first all staff meetings in 2023, we're like, meetings. Let's not do them anymore.
Let's just not have meetings.
I mean, that's a bit, it was extreme, but it was like, actually like, okay, so let's think about how we structure our time together and how we can get more out of it. And so what we did was we basically, I think a lot of people, when they come into an organization, they just like lob on to existing meetings, create new meetings. And so like my calendar as like the ED was just like nothing but meetings. And sometimes it's also like meetings that you have recurring that you cancel every week, no matter what, but then you're kind of still preparing for those meetings and they're blocked off for meetings. And so you can't do other things. And so what we did was we basically agreed that we would only take meetings on like Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then Mondays, Wednesdays, and sometimes Fridays would be doing your job, which is like mind blowing, you know,
it is.
And I've loved it because I've been able to like work on things uninterrupted, do side projects, work on policy, those kinds of things. And that's only been like a month and a half or almost 2 months now. And then the second thing we did was I've been talking to my board and my staff about like reduced work weeks, 4-day work weeks, whatever you want to call them, for years. And I've been like priming everyone for this like pet project of mine. Because also as a bad capitalist, the whole idea of becoming more productive just rankled me the weird ways. So, you know, we finally were able to put together the project. And so we launched it at the start of February, and it's going to go to the end of April for a 3-month trial. So far, working great, I think. People are still getting their things done. It feels a little rushed on certain days, but I think overall, the space that creates, that 3-day weekend, is actually quite life-changing. Like to have...
In what way? I want to get back to the meetings too, because
yes,
you rushed over both of them, but I made a note of that. So tell me, how is a 4-day work week life-changing?
It's just the mental space it creates. It's just wild how different the approaching a weekend is, where it's like, oh, it's Friday, but I don't have to work. And also I have tomorrow and Sunday to do what I need to do. So you kind of get that space to catch up on life. And I recently had a friend in from town, and like I was able to take him places on the day off, and like, it was really great. And then I feel more motivated to come back, because I'm like, oh, like I feel more creative, because you kind of need to be in that physical state, if that makes sense, to have that mindset.
Totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I try to work a 3-day work week and sometimes 4, but creating space to breathe and be and not do can free up all sorts of motivation and creativity.
Yeah. And I think also, like, from a philosophical point of view, it's one of those things where, like, you know, as I enter my mid to late 30s, I'm 36, and, you know, your family is getting older. My dad is 81 now. I lost my grandfather early this year. Like, time is just, like, precious. And for me as an ED, like, they reward you with things like, you get 5 weeks vacation time. And I'm like,
you can never use.
I can never use this.
Yeah.
Not in the way that I want to use it. So for me, having a long weekend every weekend is actually more meaningful as a reward. I wouldn't even call it reward. It's like as a human right. So yeah, that's kind of like where I'm coming from as well.
So Brandon, I'm wondering, are your staff checking their emails on the 3-day weekends?
I hope not. I try to set very strong boundaries, and I try to share with them my boundaries. So for instance, earlier in the pandemic, when we started moving everything online, we brought in new tools like Slack. For the first start of it, Slack was on my phone. And it was just, my anxiety about work was just so rampant, especially being a new ED. You're like, everything is your fault. Everything, you're in charge of everything.
Yeah.
And that was so unhealthy that I just was trying to think about, what if this was like, what if this was 1970?
Yeah.
What would work be like, right? Like, there's no email. If someone wants to contact you, you have to be sitting at your desk. And so I'm like, I thought about work that way, where I'm like, right, if I'm not at my desk, I'm not reachable. So I took off Slack from my phone, and now it's only on my laptop. So if I'm like, if I'm leaving my laptop, I tell people, they're like, I'm unreachable. If it's an emergency, please call me, but that's it. Same thing with email notifications. I turned off all my work email notifications on my phone. I still have work on my phone email, but it's not the first account that I see when I open my email inbox. So those are the kinds of things that I also share with my staff, being like, you know, do as I say and not as I do sometimes. Which is like, you know, someone's like, if I'm working at, like, last night we had our board meeting, and I was like signing off at 8 p.m. and I was like, okay, done board meeting, going home. And then someone responded and like, you shouldn't be working right now.
What are you doing right now? Well, I remember when I was an executive director as well, sometimes it takes a lot of discipline, because sometimes when it's quiet in the middle of the night, you think and you can't sleep. So you get up and you send an email. But if you actually send that email at 3 or 4 in the morning, and for me, it was before I was getting on a commuter train, you're modeling something for your staff. So there's this unwritten expectation built into those kinds of things, isn't there?
Yeah. And that's kind of like the idea is, again, be the model that you expect from your staff. And I try to live that as much as possible. So, you know, if I do work the odd evening, or if there's a, again, a grant deadline that you just have to do, you know, making sure that folks know that I'm taking time off in lieu, or like tomorrow I'm going to start at 2 instead of like 9, you know, so that they understand that it's okay to do that. Like, if you need to be flexible with your workday, that's also something I'm pretty good at. And because we're working remotely, my just ask to people is that you just be accountable to each other, right? Like, if you say you're going to be doing something at 9 a.m., do it, or tell someone that you're not going to do it, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So, this is what happens with me. I have like 10 thoughts that go through my head. None of them come out sounding any good. But what came up for me while you were talking was I got a little bit distracted with my own inner dialogue about this is not new. We've been talking about this for a long time, but we're not actually doing it for the most part, right? You're doing it. So how do you hold yourself accountable for that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, it's that mutual accountability too, right? It's, you know, when I say something to staff that we're going to do, like I want to make sure that I follow through, because I think that's also a problem in any workplaces when you make promises or you run ideas by folks and it's a good idea, but it just never happens.
Right.
And so, you know, like I said, I've been talking about 4-day work weeks forever. And finally the moment arose where it's like, now's our time, you know? And part of that was research and, you know, getting the board on board and even staff on board, because people were anxious about like, I feel overworked already. And like, if we reduce the number of days.
Right. Good point. So did you reduce the expectations?
We didn't reduce expectations. What I would say is that, we just had a serious conversation about like, you know, if this pilot is causing issues, know that we can stop it. Know that we can change course.
Right.
And so know that it's okay to provide that feedback to me. If that's like, this is actually something that's not working for me, we can look, source certain solutions, or maybe we stop it altogether. Like, again, I just like, I like the idea of piloting things because you never know until you try it.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very agile, right? Let's try it. See if we can still be productive, deliver on our mission. If we can't, we can't do this anymore. But I can't help but ask, you end up having a bunch of whiners working for you? Like, are they whining all the time?
No, my staff are like, they're great. And if anything, like the only thing I worry about is that they don't complain enough. Because I'm just like, are you just not telling me? You know?
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that when you have that relationship, where you don't like, and again, I've tried to get out of the mindset again, what I talked earlier about being the martyr. So EDs also tend to be the people who are like, if I don't do it, then nothing will happen and blah, blah, blah. But trying to share that responsibility with my team as well, and ask for help when I need it. And I know it's hard because the traditional hierarchies and power relationships are still there. You can't just say like, I'm the cool boss and like, you know, there's no repercussions from that. So you do have to be mindful about those power dynamics, especially in a small office, because I think that's where a lot of organizations, especially nonprofits, and we think about DEI work and those kinds of other intersecting identities that people have and the way that power shows up for them. Just be mindful. And then I think the one thing a lot of EDs struggle with, and you probably relate, is that, especially during the pandemic, it felt like I was kind of like the organizational therapist, without necessarily the same outlet for myself. Because your board is all, you know, they're volunteers as well, and there's only so much they can deal with. They're going through the same crisis at their organizations or their work or whatever. And then you're kind of left on your own to kind of absorb the anxiety and the issues that people are dealing with, but not necessarily have an outlet for yourself. And so that's when I like turned to my coach, like other EDs in the sector.
Or a coach. Thank you for saying
or a coach.
That.
Yes.
Yes.
This is your plug.
Thank you. I appreciate that because it is important. And I think, and my experience has been coaching is transformative for folks who are in exactly that position.
And I did have a great coach for a bit, and it did help definitely, especially when dealing with just like interesting situations that are not quote unquote normal, but should be more normal, if that makes sense. It's like, you know, you have employees with different needs and you're like, and again, because of our values as an organization, I think when you say that you are anti-oppressive, you have to do the things that are anti-oppressive.
Right.
And so,
And then
but
there's a there. I'm going to jump in here because
yeah.
I can imagine that there is a tension point there where you question, am I being anti-oppressive or am I being permissive? If I am a leader, is this a place where I should lead and have higher expectations, or should I call on my empathy and help rise, or all of the above? How do you navigate those things? And it is a little bit of a confusing thought process to work through.
And like HR processes are not meant to be anti-oppressive. Like, it's like generally speaking, it's one of those things where even going through policies piece, like, nonprofits, like our experience of policy is that we just typically would adopt, like find someone who has a policy, bring it in, approve, but it's like not made for us in that respect. And so that's part of our work this year is actually having policy audits done, because it's important work that often gets put on the side of our desk. And then we just, when a situation comes up, being like, oh no, how do we deal with this? And it's like, well, we should have a policy.
I love that you acknowledge the power dynamics and wrestle with them.
Yeah, I think that's just like that. I don't think there's a problem with having that kind of conflict. I think that's important to have, be reflective in those situations versus like, this is how it's done, this is how it's always been done. If I'm ever that confident, it's usually an indicator that something is wrong.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the mark of a great leader is knowing that that feeling that you actually everybody else around you knows more than you do.
Yeah.
Tell me about this working remotely shift. Is that a post-pandemic thing? And are you still delivering the results that you would expect?
Yeah, so when that first happened and we all worked remotely, we did this thing where we're like, we kind of missed the water cooler chat, the social aspect of work. So we initially started like a meeting to do, which was a non-meeting, which is weird. It was
A non-meeting meeting.
an optional meeting where you would, the only rule was to not talk about work. And it worked for a while. And then as the pandemic kind of,
Yeah, we all got
see
to
us
speak.
this year, like only one person or two people would show up. And so it wasn't the space that we wanted or needed again. So what we did instead, over the last year or so has been, we just said basically now the office is kind of like a work share space, which has been pretty good, where it's like you just book a desk. We still have an office space. It's smaller than our old office, but the rent is actually pretty reasonable considering the commercial real estate. It's worked in our favor, at least as a nonprofit, the vacancies in commercial real estate. And so we still do most of our work remotely, but we do drop into the office when we need to do this. Kind of like I like working in person, but recognize that not everyone is at that point still. And like our staff are still getting COVID, right? So if I had made the decision to make everyone go to the office, I would have COVID right now. Like, so like that, it's still out there. And even just two people in the last month got it. And again, our queer and trans community, more, I would say a disproportionate number of us have immunocompromised
No, it's just a
systems.
fact.
Yeah. So, so we're used to dealing with quote unquote plagues. And so just being careful and mindful.
Well, that's definitely community to follow for new ways of managing sick days and health again,
Yeah, I think for me, it's just always asking the question of why. Like, why do I have to do this thing? Or why do we only have 6 sick days? Where did this number come from? Who pulled this out of the air,
And let's just name it. I think that a mental health day, I love the idea that folks are saying, yeah, I just can't do work today. Like, I think that's great. I do that
I
all
would rather that than them be like sit at their desk and get more unwell, like
Exactly. Yes, because that's what leads to burnout. That's what leads to staff turnover. But I have to ask, are you still delivering the same community impact that you were given all of these things? Because this conversation sounds so far like a tea party for staff.
Yeah, I think I believe we are. Like, all of our metrics are pretty good. Like, it's been a rough 3 years, and my general mindset for impact, or like the programming piece, has not been to be feel pressured to kind of go back to normal, if that makes sense. So we were like, last year was kind of the first year without restrictions, at least by the summer. And I didn't push us to do like, let's just go back to 2019 numbers and 2019 programming. It was like, what's reasonable this year? Like, what is our limit feel like? And so we were like, we'll do half. Let's just do half and see how that feels.
Right.
And I can say that like, even half felt a bit too much for us this year, from a capacity perspective. But I would say we're still delivering on our programming, and we're still like, especially the schools program was able to pivot really easily to Zoom and Microsoft Teams and whatever. And now that we're back in person, that demand has just only skyrocketed. And so I would say it's working well. I would generally say it's like, yeah, it's getting over that distrust. Also, I think sometimes I can't say for bigger organizations, but at least for us, like, we're a very tight knit team. And so we have to work really closely together, and we have to get along. We don't have to be friends, but we just, you know, we have to have good working relationships. And getting over that fear of being taken advantage of, I think, is really important, even when it comes to our programming. So for instance, like, pay what you can ticketing. People are like, well, how are you going to make any revenue? And I'm like, well, we've been offering a sliding scale during the pandemic from $5 to $21, and people are paying what they can. Like, people, like, majority of people are still paying full price for everything that we offer, even though we've given them the option to pay less. And so that's like, that helped me also with staff, of being like, no one is here to kind of take advantage of you. Like, again, I think because we are a mission-driven organization as nonprofits, like, the core, like, why people join us is not necessarily a salary, which we are trying to change. But I think it is key to, like, that impact piece, I think, continues to drive people. And so I don't see any folks taking advantage of these kinds of quote unquote new perks per se, at least yet.
Well, time will tell. It sounds amazing. It sounds like you're in the mecca of nonprofit organizations. You mentioned earlier that you were an empath. I feel you. How does that help you navigate all of these changes?
I mean, part of it is going through it myself and processing my own feelings and experiences as an ED, and kind of like, what do I need? If I'm like experiencing this, like, do other people need this too? You know, and also being a bit more empathetic with myself, because again, we love being martyrs. And so I'm of no use to anyone if I'm burnt out. So I was very close last year. And so I think a lot of these changes have been very helpful, but also because we've been able to find, I think partially because we've been able to raise and increase salaries and make commitments, that we're finding staff more easily. It's still a challenge just given inflation and the labor market, but that's been of great help to me. And then I think it's also just like being able to read the room sometimes. Like, it's I don't know if it's a skill or if it's just like, just you as a human being, but
that not everybody can do it. It's an empath thing for sure.
Yeah, it's like, even with conversations with donors or supporters, or, you know, even talking to people who might not like your mission, or, like, again, because the queer and trans community is becoming more and more under fire. It's, again, reading kind of like where all this is coming from, and like having that intuition to be like, what can I do in this moment to counter this energy, to bring more energy to, you know, and I think that's very helpful. It's hard to explain as a skill, but it's like, it's there though, you know?
It's a feeling. I know. So how do you protect yourself? You mentioned a few of the things that you do. All of these things you do for your staff are ways that you protect yourself, I guess. So that might have sounded like a silly question, but is there something more?
I mean, that's it. I mean, the more I'm able to support my team, the less I have to worry, and the less I have to like engage in direct work where I can do quote unquote, like the ED job. It's, I don't know. I miss being like a program coordinator because you get to do the direct things. And but now it's like, oh, now you're just administrating, but like it is a lot of work. And part of it is trying to find that balance. I don't know if I'm, last year was definitely not an example of that. And I think I've learned from last year of like what we need in place to make space for ourselves. And again, trying to focus the idea around like, you know, people always ask like, what's your dream job? I'm like, I do not dream of labor, you know, like
That is not the dream, my
that
friend.
is not the dream. The dream is to not work. I would love to retire tomorrow.
Well, that brings me to another curiosity I had about you. You mentioned that you're a bad capitalist. And I was just like, that's got to be the name of this podcast. What is a bad capitalist from your perspective, Brandon?
It's again one of those things where it's like, for instance, like, and you know, when it comes to the film festival, like revenue from tickets doesn't excite me. You know, it's bums in seats, who's coming, who's making sure they're invited and they feel safe and welcome. You know, it's, you know, oftentimes people put the revenue question ahead of expenses, but I actually think, I think I told you, but like, and it's not, I did not invent this term, but it's, or this phrase, but it's like that your budget is a moral document. And so how, you know, I like spending money, and I will raise it and I will question it, but I also, you know, don't think that, I don't know. I think also being a bad capitalist is endearing to some folks because it's like, you're not in it for the money. Like they understand that you're not coming for their pocketbook. You're in it for all the other reasons, you know? And sometimes that works against my own interests, which is like, yes, if I was not working in nonprofits, someone with 2 degrees should be making much more money. But would I be happier? I don't know. You know,
you're fired up right now.
That's, so yeah. Could I make the same impact? Not sure. And then part, some days I told you, like some days I just want to run away to the Japanese countryside and farm, you know, like that's the dream, is to be able to like have that space. But at this point, I think I still have lots of energy left, but yeah. And it's like also being a steward is really cool. Like being a steward of an organization that has such a long history and has so much more to give. Because it's not my organization. It doesn't belong to anyone. So how do I use my experiences to inform it now and then hopefully leave it in a better shape than when I found it, you know?
So your next executive director can come on when your season is over.
Yeah. And it's again, like setting them up for success. Cause again, I think it's that succession part in every small nonprofit is always a question mark. And I think for me, even thinking about what I want next is hard. Cause it's one of the things where like, when is a good time to leave? When you're a team of 8 people and there's no one else that has the information in your brain. So for instance, this budget that I just got passed last night,
congratulations.
I was like, I need a deputy or an associate for that plan. Like we just need, and like, again, do I have the revenue in place for it at the moment? No, but it just means that we have to find it. Right. Like, I think that there's always that possibility. And we'll, you know, cross those funding pieces when we get to it.
What I love about all of what you just said is when you focus on, you know, this concept of being a bad capitalist is kind of interesting to me, because when I was consulting, I would, you know, often say to organizations, if I could wave a magic wand and help you focus on mission delivery instead of this budget that's due in 6 months' time, and stop worrying about the money, the abundance will follow. It always follows.
That's the weird thing about it, right? The more you're able to actually do the things, the more people notice.
Yes.
And the more they want to help. And so that's the thing, is like, we have to get out of the scarcity mindset, because if we just, especially during the pandemic, I saw lots of organizations panic and they like laid off staff. They like, you know, even before our funding announcements were like, we're going to give you Qs and like the wage subsidies and stuff like that. But they had already let all their staff go. And it's like, you just lost so much potential. And we were able to retain all of our staff during the pandemic because of those grants and those subsidies. And now those folks are still with us. And so we are in a better position than some other organizations because we were able to put people first, even if we weren't able to program as much as we would like to.
That's beautiful. It's beautiful. So if this conversation was to end right now, what have we left unsaid?
Ooh, I mean, everything with a grain of salt. Not everything, like, even though it sounds really great, like, it's, nothing is black and white. It's still a very gray area for lots of us moving into these pieces. If you're considering change and whatnot, it's not easy and it's not fast. But that's also great about it sometimes. The process, and again, rolling my eyes if this is a podcast, so you can't see me. But, it's about the process too, right? Like, how do you bring people along for the change? And as much as I wanted 4-day work weeks, it just took a while to get there. But we're there. And so know that it can happen, even if it's not immediate. And again, it might sound great and the grass is always greener, but I don't know. Stick with it. Be a bad capitalist as much as you can. I don't believe in things like clean money, so it's always having those philosophical debates about funding and who gives you money and what money you don't take and what you're comfortable with. I love having those conversations with staff because it also involves them in the questions and also, like, again, also motivates them because they understand that, like, even if we take money from XYZ, it doesn't mean we're beholden to those particular interests, but we are doing good work. Does that make it better? I don't know. But yeah, complication is sometimes fun. So,
You seem proud of the work that you're doing at Out on Screen.
I say so. I think it's like, sometimes I get upset when I see bigger nonprofits with bigger budgets and they're hiring people at $15 an hour. And I'm just like, we apply for the same grants. And if I can offer someone $24 as minimum wage and you're still offering 15, but you say you have the same values as we do.
You don't. You don't, buddy. You
Yeah,
don't.
I'm definitely throwing a bit of shade here at the Vancouver nonprofit sector. And I know not every organization is in the same spot. Like, I know that a lot of the privilege that I have has been built on the successes of previous EDs and people, but, like, yeah, you just kind of have to just take a chance sometimes and, make sure that you're telling people why it's worth it, like, when a donor has a good experience with a staff member being like, yeah, your donation pays for them to live a good life in a very expensive city, a good life. I mean, we're
Yeah,
being.
no, but I know what you mean. It's because they're happy, not stressed out, and not grumpy talking to you, because we take care of them.
And
And
if they are grumpy, I want to have that conversation. Like, I want to know why
yeah,
things are not going well, or, like,
well, you're talking. We could go on forever and ever, but
yeah.
what you have done is you have created what is called psychological safety. And when an organization has psychological safety, you can do so much more.
And I would say who I would credit for that is literally my past supervisors. I've learned by example about, we all learn by example about kind of, like, as an employee, what worked really well for me. And it doesn't work for everyone, but, like, I try to emulate those same, pieces. Like, for instance, my last job where my supervisor was like, you know what? This organization says it has its values, the one we're currently working in. I don't know if I believe it. So let's figure out what we can do and, like, where's your next spot? Because I think that you have more to offer than we can give you, And so it's like, I want that relationship with my staff being like, you know what? Like, there actually isn't another position for you to move into. And I think you're exceeding at this one. So, like, how do I help you get to that next spot?
So you're helping them advance in their own, in their profession, whether it's within your organization or not.
And that's, again, part of the mission, right? Like, supporting 2S LGBTQ people succeed in their life, right? Like, that is the what is it? The not the mission, but the vision of our organization is where gender and sexual diversity thrives, right? So, like, ultimately, I see this part of my work, right? So that's kind of going back to full circle to the beginning of this conversation.
That's just great. Thank you so much for making this a priority the week before you go on your vacation. I know you have so much to do, and I'm so very grateful to have met you, Brandon. Thank you for being here.
Of course, likewise.
Well, there you have it. I told you so. A real example of an organization that is banishing martyrdom, prioritizing their people, and delivering community impact. Why not share this episode with your staff and talk with your whole team about the kinds of changes needed in your organization that can create a safer space for them? If that sounds too hard, reach out to me. It's kind of my superpower. I'd be happy to help you. This was just the first of 8 fabulous episodes this season. We are talking to In the Trenches leaders who are paving a newer, healthier way forward for our sector. We are going to talk about anti-racism in action, trust-based philanthropy, and more about how to take care of the mental, physical, and spiritual well-being of those working so hard to do so much to make the world a better place. So don't miss any of it. Be sure to join our email list at intersectionhub.ca or subscribe directly on any platform where you get your podcasts. And please be in touch if you have suggestions for other organizations we can talk to next season. We are always grateful for your feedback. We are continuing to get better and better at this, and we want to know what you think. So please send your feedback. Share some referrals, share this podcast, let us know what's on your mind. We would love to hear from you, but mostly, thank you so much for being part of this conversation today. See you next time.